Today on Edge Effects.
I have mixed feelings about the March for Science. And part of that comes from thinking about the first Earth Day in 1970, which we have remembered it as a big demonstration. But in fact, it was much more than that. It was much more educational. We need to have deeper soul-searching conversations about why we care about this and what we're willing to do about it.
Environmental historian Andy Davey speaks with Adam Rome, professor of history at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Rome is the author of The Genius of Earth Day. Together, they look ahead to this week's March for Science, reflecting on how the role of activist scientists has changed over the last four decades, and what today's climate scientists could learn from the first Earth Day.
All right. Thank you, Adam Rome, for taking some time to talk with me today for EdgeFX as we look forward here to the upcoming March for Science. Really looking forward to getting your insights based on your research on Earth Day, and also hear a bit about your recent research project and your latest book. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Andy. Looking forward to talking.
Wonderful. Your book, The Genius of Earth Day, has been really important for my own research on the history of environmental studies, the origins in the 60s and 70s. And there's a lot of great stories and great analysis in that book. And one of the interesting things that you talk about is the role of scientists in the environmental movement in that first Earth Day. And you said that the environmental activism of science was both surprising and predictable in Earth Day 1970, the first Earth Day. Could you say a little bit about why it was both surprising and predictable?
Well, it was surprising because scientists had this ideal of detachment. They really prided themselves on not getting involved in politics or in broader social issues of any kind. They were very different than a lot of professionals who had an ethic of service. So it really went against their canon in some ways to speak out. On the other hand, it was really predictable because all the environmental issues of the day, whether it was pollution or sprawl or hazardous waste or pesticides or population was a big issue at the time, they all had scientific components. So there were always things that scientists might have thought about more than the average citizen they could bring to the table. And that's certainly how many of them ultimately came to feel that it was their duty, in spite of all the longstanding traditions against public speaking, to speak out.
Yeah, okay, great. So this tradition or sort of way of thinking about their work as being detached from politics or from moral and ethical values or maybe an appeal to objectivity, how did they overcome that exactly, or how did they sort of navigate that tension?
I should have said, too, that there were some scientists all along. Barry Commoner would be the best example, who always had ideological commitments. He was a lefty going back to the Depression years. So he always did think that scientists had an obligation to make sure their science served the people, that it didn't just serve the narrow interests, the selfish interests of an elite. But for many of the others, I think they had almost to be backed into a corner. And Rachel Carson was really critical. A lot of the ecologists, for example, scientists who worked on ecosystems, even after the fallout issue, which Barry Commoner had really raised to prominence, the issue of radiation from atomic weapons testing, it really wasn't until Rachel Carson's Silent Spring that a lot of ecologists began to say, oh my God, you know, these issues are clearly important. They're potentially earth-shaking. We can't just leave it to journalists, even journalists who had trained in science like Rachel Carson, that we've got to do something. And so by the mid-60s, the Ecological Society of America and other professional organizations were having debates within their own membership about how much they were obliged to speak out and where the limits were they might draw were. Was capitalism an environment, you know, an ecological issue was one of the debates people had. So they didn't all agree. But more and more by the mid to late 60s, there were folks who were beginning to think that they needed to speak out. And the ones who did speak out really became prophetic. I mean, they were often talked about as Jeremiahs, the modern prophets shouting out to the people to reform. And that didn't sit well with everyone, but it was more and more common by the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. And to what degree would you say that scientists were pushing broader public or sort of non-scientist citizens? They were the ones pushing the agenda, or vice versa, that it was really only after citizens were making a number of statements and demands for scientists to get involved that they stepped in. What was that dynamic like?
I think it was mostly scientists beginning to think that they had a duty. And as I said, they were pushed, especially by Silent Spring, but they really weren't pushed yet by a broad popular call for scientists to be involved. I mean, there really was no environmental movement in the 1960s. There were lots of people working on individual environmental issues, but no one had a sense that there was a broader environmental crisis before the lead up to the first Earth Day in 1970. So I think the scientists were leaders more than followers. And, you know, one other thing that I didn't write about in the book, but that I've come to think is more important because it's such a contrast with today, with climate scientists particularly. A lot of the scientists who came to be active, they weren't active because of their own research. They weren't necessarily doing cutting edge research on any of the topics like pollution or sprawl that they ended up talking about. For many of them, it came out of their teaching sometimes that, you know, they would be teaching an introductory bio course and trying to make it more relevant. Or it came out of reading the journal Science, which really by the late 60s had become a kind of continuing education course in environmental problems. So I think a lot of the scientists that spoke out, they really saw themselves really as scientifically literate citizens. They weren't primarily speaking as experts on the cutting edge of research. And I think that's really different than the climate scientists now, the people like Jim Hansen or Michael Mann, who are doing the cutting edge science that's telling us more about climate change, but they've also come to think they need to speak out. And they have to balance a different set of expectations than some of the people in the late 60s, early 70s, who really weren't worried about how people viewed their research or whether they were going to get grants if they spoke out or any of the other things that now, you know, the climate change scientists had to worry about. They also, for that matter, weren't worried about getting attacked. No one was going to subpoena their emails or do any of the other things that have been used lately to intimidate scientists.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison. Do you think that because they were speaking more as scientifically educated citizens, that people were less likely to kind of claim they were somehow self-serving in advocating in the way that they were, which you sort of see today with climate skepticism, that it's, oh, these climate scientists, they're really just self-interested because they're advocating for a cause that, you know, is kind of their own, for their own monetary gain?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think anyone, I certainly can't recall seeing anyone get charged with the idea that they were sounding alarms simply to get more grants, you know, to have more graduate students and teach less courses. There really wasn't the sense then. And part of that also was the business community was naive in a literal way. They hadn't really ever been challenged in this way before, and they hadn't yet figured out how to counterattack in the late 60s and early 70s. Now they're much more sophisticated. They have all kinds of ways of trying to cast doubt on the science, among other things. Back in the 60s and 70s, that wasn't really the case. I think people were respectful when scientists spoke, but the scientists also were, you know, that I'm thinking of, people like Wes Jackson, who I wrote about in my book, who was one of the first people to have a textbook on environmental studies and one of the directors, one of the first environmental studies programs. But, you know, he felt free to talk about philosophy and religion and economics and politics, along with biology. You know, his professional specialty was genetics, but he never drew on that in the public speaking that he did in the Earth Day era. He was quite upfront about the fact that these were more than just scientific questions, although they all had a scientific component. And I think people would sometimes argue with them about whether they were exaggerating, whether the situation was as dire as they painted it. But even that really wasn't questioning their science. Scientists would say things that were basically, if things don't change, this might happen. And then the big question is, well, what might make them change? Will they change? The scientists usually didn't weigh in on that. They just said, if things don't change, we face this problem or that problem or this catastrophe or that disaster. But they often left it to others to fill in that big question of whether we would change and what would make us change and what kind of change would be most effective.
Mm-hmm. So from some of the courses I've taken and the research I've done and things I've read, it does seem like there was some emerging kind of skepticism or mistrust of science and technology, partly in response to the atomic bomb and fallout and some of these environmental problems that people were starting to see, oh, wait a minute, isn't it the scientists and the technology that partly have fault? Did you see any of that going on prior to Earth Day, or was that just so minimal that it didn't really come to the fore in terms of how folks thought about scientists?
Oh, that, I think that's another great question. And in fact, I think it helps answer the question you asked before about why they didn't get more pushback. Because the scientists that spoke out around Earth Day, they were totally upfront about the fact that they thought a lot of science had gone astray, that we had developed new technologies that turned out to have horribly unexpected and dangerous side effects or unintended consequences. So there was something inherently humbling about the scientific claim that we needed to do more. It was saying that science didn't have all the answers, or at least it hadn't so far, that scientists and the people that put their science to use had failed to anticipate some of these problems. So I think that helped make them seem more credible, that they weren't holding science up as some sort of godlike, omniscient thing, and everyone else was an idiot and just needed to listen to them. They were saying just the opposite. Science was an incredibly powerful force that we hadn't entirely learned how to control. And the scientists maybe had some better understandings of the way in which it could get out of control than ordinary people, but they certainly weren't saying that they had all the answers. You know, one of the other people I wrote about, Lamont Cole, who was a Cornell ecologist, you know, his big theme was, how dumb are we? You know, we were conducting all these incredible experiments. We were doing things that were unprecedented, and they might turn out to be harmless, or they might turn out to be just beneficial, but they also might turn out in some cases to be catastrophic. And he was totally upfront about the fact that he was constantly learning new things, coming to appreciate that there were new hazards that he hadn't suspected. So I think there was a humility, a modesty among the scientists, even as they also were claiming a certain amount of scientific authority. And that went well with the growing popular sense that we were creating these marvels that also had a dark side.
And how would you compare that to the March for Science today and the sort of politics of today? And I know as a historian, historians are often not always wanting to comment on contemporary things. But just from your perspective, how do those dynamics compare with the rhetoric about science and trusting in science and the role of science in our environmental problems today?
I'm not sure about what I'm about to say, but I think even though I'm totally sympathetic to the science itself, I'm totally convinced that climate change is a very, 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 very serious problem. It's going to take all the wisdom that we can muster to adapt to it and to try to prevent it from being worse than it otherwise might be. But I also think that the scientists, some of them, they sound more arrogant today in some ways because they're most often talking about work that they're actually doing. And they're pretty totally confident that the work that they're doing is really good. And they can't understand why people don't see that. So a lot of the scientists today, even the ones who are most outspoken, they're in the unusual position that a lot of the Earth Day era scientists weren't, of having to defend their own life work and their own integrity. And some of them can do that with aplomb and modesty, but some of them end up coming off as saying basically, you idiot. And, you know, they try not to, but, you know, and in their own world, of course, they're constantly being questioned by colleagues to make sure that they haven't overlooked things. But that might be part of the problem, that a lot of, especially with climate change, that the scientists find it so hard to believe that anyone doesn't understand how dire the things are that they think are dire. It's hard to make that point without coming across as condescending, perhaps. But again, I'm not really sure of that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Adam. And it leads me just to kind of a speculative thought about climate change politics and advocacy. I mean, I wonder if it would behoove climate change activists to try to recruit non-climate scientists to be more vocal or take on more leadership roles. And maybe they are, and I just don't notice them because they're not getting media attention, but to sort of recreate some of those dynamics of the 60s and 70s where, you know, smart, well-educated scientists who don't necessarily have a vested personal interest in climate science who could come out and sort of speak intelligently about it. What do you think about that?
I think there are a lot of other voices beside those of scientists who are calling for us to change. Although actually, you know, for anyone listening who's a graduate student, I think this is a great topic that no one's explored. Josh has written a wonderful book about the role of science in the politics of climate change, but he didn't really look at how environmentalists over the years framed the issues and how that's changed, or why the issue even has been framed so overwhelming as an environmental issue. It could also be framed as a national security issue or an economic issue or an issue of community, obviously a moral issue. So I think that there's a lot we don't know about why environmentalists have been so quick to say it's all about the science. You know, again, even that one of the organizations that I most admire, 350.org, you know, you go to their website and the first thing it says basically is science says, you know. But in fact, science doesn't really say hardly as much as people think. I think climate change both is and isn't a scientific issue. If we want to address the problem, of course, we need good science. We need to understand exactly what's changing and the likely consequences of it. But whether we want to do something about climate change isn't ultimately a scientific question. And even when it seems to be, I think the battle over science is often a proxy war where the real battle is more ideological or even temperamental than it is purely about whether you, quote, believe the science or accept the science. So I think there are other voices, but it's an interesting historical question that no one, to my knowledge, has really tried to answer yet. Why the other voices who could have made independent arguments, independent of science, haven't been more forceful in insisting that ultimately these aren't scientific questions, what we do and don't do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about. And in a piece you wrote for the Huffington Post a few years ago, you mentioned that in order to make some progress on climate change, we're going to have to do some serious soul searching. Where do you see kind of signs of that? Or maybe as we think about the March for Science, do you see those soul searching conversations happening alongside, or is the sort of debates and arguments and really heated rhetoric around science just kind of getting in the way and overshadowing those soul searching conversations?
Yeah, I think we've allowed the science, as you suggest, to dwarf a lot of the other possible conversations. And it's not even just, quote, the science. It's a particular kind of science. If you read some of the memoirs or the op-eds of the scientists that write about this, they always devote way more space than I think is appropriate to how they learned what they now think they know. You know, when I go to the doctor, if he tells me I have a tumor, I'm really not that interested in how he came to be able to diagnose the tumor, as long as I trust that he's a good doctor. You know, what I want to know is, how is it going to affect me? Is it something that's an urgent problem? Is it something I can live with for a long time without it really harming me? You know, what kind of treatments are there, and what do they cost, both, you know, economically and psychically? And might the treatments, some cases, be worse than the problem? Those are the kinds of things that scientists don't tend to talk about as much. And journalists have done a better job. There's a wonderful book. It's now pretty old, I think like 2008. By Mark Linus, called 6 Degrees, that just took the best scientific understanding at the time of what happens if we have warming of 1 degree, and then what happens, that's one chapter, and then what happens if we have warming of 2 degrees, and what happens if we have warming of 3 degrees, and 4 degrees, and 5 degrees, and 6 degrees. Even that is something that we don't get very often from the scientists, the detailed sense of how this is going to affect our Earth, our part of the Earth, our relationships, our communities, our work, everything else that we care about. So I don't think we've been talking enough about that. And I think we need to. And marches aren't the place to do that kind of talking either. I have mixed feelings about the March for Science. And part of that comes from thinking about the first Earth Day in 1970, which we have remembered it as a big demonstration. But in fact, it was much more than that. It was much more educational. And that's what I was trying to get at in that Huffington Post piece, that we need to have deeper soul-searching conversations about why we care about this and what we're willing to do about it. In some cases, it's win-win. You know, the things you want to do actually would help you in other ways. In other cases, you might have to make a sacrifice. But those aren't scientific questions, and they call for, I can't even think of that many forums where I've seen a scientist sitting down with a religious leader and, you know, a union member and, you know, whatever else, to have a conversation about what global warming or climate change means to them, where the scientist is really just talking as a scientifically literate citizen, not as someone with special and somewhat arcane knowledge.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I recently, with a colleague of mine, Eric Noss, wrote a review for EdgeFX on Arleigh Russell Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, and then a book about Wisconsin here by a political scientist, Kathy Kramer. And both of those books, they're really trying to understand why, in particular, rural, white, working and middle class folks are gravitating towards Tea Party politics and sort of conservative populist movement that arguably is part of why Donald Trump got elected, and really trying to understand their worldview. And it does seem that part of their worldview is this feeling that they've been disrespected and misunderstood by experts and elites in various kinds of capacities, in government, in the academy, but also in science. And there's a sense that scientists are this sort of expert other that have a kind of knowledge that disrespects and disregards their sort of local experiential knowledge, but also their emotional experience, their sort of place in the world. And yeah, I mean, I wonder what it would look like to try to hold, I know there's lots of these conversations going on, and, you know, in Wisconsin, the Department of Natural Resources is doing this kind of stuff all the time. But I wonder if there's a way to sort of elevate those conversations as part of the sort of, this is central to climate change. This isn't just incidental, but we need to be having these conversations around the country.
Yeah, I mean, rural people is a really interesting case. And what you said about those Wisconsin studies is fascinating to me, because I do think there is a deep sense of that condescension. I mean, I just moved into a new house and had a lot of people working on it, and they were all nice to me personally. But, you know, it was during the election and after, and a lot of them, I think, made it clear in different ways that they felt that, you know, that people weren't listening to them. And I think some of it is trying to get past code words. Farmers, are, in many cases, are more affected by climate change than any of us already, right now. They're feeling the effects in many parts of the country, but they're also conservative in other ways, and they're loath to talk about climate change in that exact way, because for them, it has a lot of baggage. It goes with bigger government. It goes with limits on their freedom and to make decisions about their business, all kinds of things like that. And I think some people have done some interesting experiments to try to find ways of talking about the issues without using the loaded terms. And even the word environmentalist, some environmentalists are beginning to reject, those who have to work more often with rural people. And they're going back to the older language of conservation, because that doesn't have the same baggage. So this is so complicated. Again, I think there's a lot of room for historians to look more into this. How did it come to be just literally unthinkable for certain kinds of people to worry about climate change, at least if that's how it's defined, even when they might have self-interests that are directly affected? That would be very useful research. And rhetoric really matters. People that work in politics have been saying that for decades.
Yeah, I really agree with you. And I mean, certainly taking into account the research like Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway did in Merchants of Doubt, that there is obviously powers that be that are pushing their agenda in order to sow doubt. But even with all that, it does seem that, yeah, there's a lot of uncharted ground there in terms of why so many people have taken the position they have on climate change.
And, you know, and even with science, you could have some really interesting discussions and you wouldn't know how they turn out specifically. But my own faith is that they would be helpful no matter how they turned out specifically about science. And what do people think of when they use that phrase? And what parts of science do they take for granted are good, and what parts of science trouble them? You know, what do they think of scientists as people? There are a lot of interesting questions that you could be having right now. That sounds detached from all the horrible budget proposals and everything else that are the day-to-day news lately. But in the long run, I think that was the secret of Earth Day. A lot of the Earth Day conversations, they did lead to immediate change. People resolved to do something right away to make things better. But they also empowered people in ways that ultimately led to lasting, lifelong changes. And, I think we could do the same thing with science. I think we could say, science isn't all good. It never has been. You know, the idea of the mad scientist is at least 200 years old now. And then we have this, you know, the other ideal of the scientist in the white coat who knows everything and smiles and, you know, things just happen that are miraculous. Science is a complicated thing. And again, I think people are loath to talk about the complexities of it because they feel so pressured day to day to defend the satellites that are providing vital data about our atmosphere that might be cut or turned off, you know, if we don't stop the budget. But I think we need to have both that short-term sense of what's at stake right at the moment, but also the longer-term sense that these issues aren't going away. We're going to have to be thinking about them for a long time. And so any investment we make now in getting people to think deeper and more richly about them is going to pay off, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think those of us in the academy, especially who are doing, you know, somewhat interdisciplinary work, environmental history is a rather interdisciplinary field by its subject, how might we start to facilitate some of those conversations?
Some of it can start as simply as reminding the scientists that, you know, they love the phrase, for example, evidence-based decision-making or science-based decision-making. And, you know, on the one hand, more than I thought I could possibly feel 6 months ago, you know, the assault on truth really cuts to the bone for all of us who are scholars in the Trump world. You know, if people can't agree on certain facts, forgetting what they mean or what to do about them, all is lost, really. But on the other hand, you know, I remember when I was at the University of Delaware, I just moved there for an environmental humanities job, and the head of the Environmental Institute at the university, who was really a wonderful person, I loved working with that institute, put together a forum that brought together scientists, social scientists, and humanists to talk about how they think about issues and where they have things in common and where they don't. And you know, the most revelatory moment for me was the scientists saying over and over, you know, we need evidence-based policy. We need, scientifically informed policy. And I kept saying, you know, from my perspective as a humanist, there's some bedrock of science that you maybe need to understand, but none of the interesting questions ultimately in policy are scientific. That's the message that we can spread to the scientists, I think. And many of them already understand that, but some of them don't. And some of their allies, you know, because science has a powerful authority, or at least in some circles, you know, I think a lot of people who aren't scientists have hoped to stifle debate essentially by saying science says this, as though you can't argue with it, rather than have to say, you know, my values say this, or my faith says this, or my aesthetics say this, all of which is debatable.
Yeah, those are excellent points, and I wholeheartedly agree. And I guess I'm interested in switching gears a little bit and talking more about your recent book. And I think there's definitely some connections to what we already talked about in terms of the role of business in the first Earth Day and sort of thinking about lots of different kinds of models for moving forward with really thorny, nasty questions about sustainability and the role of environmentalism and the economy. But I guess before we do that, are there any other thoughts that you have about the March for Science or kind of reflecting on the history of Earth Day that I didn't ask you about?
I think one thing about Earth Day that really struck me, it was the idea of a Senator Gaylor Nelson, and he allowed basically anyone to do anything they wanted on Earth Day and call it Earth Day. He didn't try to impose his ideas about what counted as an environmental issue or how to approach it. And, you know, as a result, I think it was an incredibly ecumenical day, as one organizer told me. It brought together all kinds of people. And there was also a lot of debate about the relationship between environmental issues and everything else that was going on at the time, the social unrest and the political unrest and the war and feminism and poverty. You know, and I think that's part of the broader vision with sustainability, too. It you know, sustainability has roots as an environmental issue. People first started to think about, can we sustain the earth as a place that supports human civilization? But it's not just an environmental issue. It's also an economic issue, a political issue, a social issue, a cultural issue, a moral issue. And I think, again, the more that we can do to acknowledge that, the better. I think a lot of people on the first Earth Day understood that. The best thinkers about sustainability understand that. But it's also easy to compartmentalize, and that's a problem.
In terms of your latest research thread, you've got this edited volume that just came out, I think, this month, called Green Capitalism.
Question mark.
Green Capitalism. Sorry. I need to pronounce that right now.
Hey.
We're doing an audio podcast. Yeah. So just maybe to start with, could you tell me a little bit about how your research moved in that direction. How did you get interested in the questions you ultimately explored in that volume?
So the volume is trying to provide historical perspective, and not just from the United States. We had contributors from Europe and people who wrote about Europe as well as the U.S., to this big question of whether capitalism ever can be green. And for environmental historians, you know, in a sense, I guess the field began with the assumption that the answer would be no. You know, that Don Worster and Dust Bowl and others following him blamed capitalism more than anything else for the environmental degradation of the last several centuries. And I don't question that at all. I mean, I'm a Don Worster student. That was partly what attracted me to him, was his critique of capitalism. But when I went to the University of Delaware, which is right near the Hagley Museum and Library, it's one of the preeminent places in the world to study business and technology history. I met with the director there, and he suggested maybe we could have a conference that would bring business historians together with environmental historians. And I thought that would be fantastic, because I already had the sense, I had done some research about business and the environment in the Earth Day era that I didn't end up incorporating into the book. And the story was more complicated than I expected. It wasn't just that business opposed the environmental initiatives of the time. And so this conference that we did that ultimately led to the volume that includes some work that wasn't at the conference really was partly motivated by the sense that there have been times in history, and they're more frequent in recent history, when businesses have tried to conserve resources, or they have tried to protect certain kinds of spaces, or they have worried about how much waste they were producing. And until recently, those businesses were dwarfed by those who weren't thinking about the environment at all, or were taking it for granted as a place that they could just dump stuff and use up. But I had the sense that there was a lot more to say about what are the limits? What does history tell us about the limits to how far business can go if it wants to try to do better? Where can it go right, and where is it inherently unable to address problems that the market itself has created? So that was the inspiration for the volume. And my own piece in it starts with a 1993 book by Paul Hawken, just called The Ecology of Commerce, that became a bestseller. And he was an entrepreneur. I mean, he came out of a hippie-ish background, but he was a business guy, a small businessman. He didn't fit neatly into the category of who was an environmentalist. He wasn't a Washington-based lobbyist. He wasn't a grassroots activist. But he was clearly making an argument that business needed to do better. It was the most dynamic and powerful institution in society. It was responsible for a huge amount of our environmental problems, but it was also impossible to see, for him at least, how we could solve those problems if business didn't become part of the solution. So over time, a lot more people have begun to think like that. And I think it's a rich topic, even though it's relatively recent history, for historians to consider.
And what were some of the more surprising stories or things you found out in the research that you did?
Well, some of it was stuff that was already there and I just hadn't looked at it before. So, for example, Hugh Gorman has a wonderful book that's not nearly as well known as it should be, called Redefining Efficiency, that's about the oil industry and the environment before Earth Day. So it ends in the late 60s. And I had that book on my shelf, but I hadn't read it until I was thinking about this conference. And it was fascinating, because the oil industry was well aware early in the 20th century that it was causing a whole host of environmental problems. And it was also well aware that it was wasting a lot of crude, that it was not using as wisely as it might this vital resource. And their argument, and there were people who wanted to regulate the industry at different times, well before Earth Day. And the oil industry's response always was, the problems will get better. We'll produce less pollution, and we'll cause fewer environmental problems, and we'll waste less as we become more efficient. And Gorman's argument is that was partly true. They did make progress up to a point, but the progress was dwarfed ultimately, or negated, by two other factors. So one was just the sheer scale of the industry kept growing. So even though they were more efficient, the sum total of the problems they were causing kept increasing. And the other was that not all the problems were amenable to profitable solution. You know, they weren't the kind of thing that the business was going to do in an effort to become more efficient. they were just going to be costs, and there was nothing that would force them to do that in the market itself. So his conclusion is that self-regulation by the oil industry under this promise that as it got more efficient, the problems would decline, by the late 60s was clearly, to most people, false, a false hope. And that people then came to the conclusion that they needed regulation, they needed government action to force the industry to do better than it would have done on its own. And that, I think, is the more general story of the whole Earth Day era, is people coming to conclude that the problems weren't just going to go away as we became more prosperous. They might even get worse, or they were likely to get worse. And so I think that's a valuable lesson, especially in the Trump era, to remember that we have all the regulation we have for a reason. Business tried and failed to deal with this on its own, and not just the oil industry. So that was one thing that intrigued me. But there were a lot of others.
Great. Any other stories you wanna tell?
Well, I think, you know, the other thing that's hard for environmental historians, and I never thought about this until this conference, you know, even though my own first book is partly about business and the environment, I didn't really try to get in the head of the developers that I wrote about. I was much more interested in the people critiquing them. But it made me realize when I was thinking about this conference and I was starting to read some of the management literature and some of the writings by business people who saw themselves as pioneers in green business, that it really is important to understand from the inside the decision making that people make. There are a lot more gray areas, and it doesn't mean you can't be critical, but recognizing the forces that shape the decisions that business make, I think is crucial. And again, I think it's a historical question, you know, that businesses have changed over time. You know, I spent a lot of time looking at the DuPont company, and, you know, there were some valuable lessons, I think, that I've already learned. I'm not done. About what kinds of pressures really were important in DuPont deciding to do certain things differently. We've overestimated how important citizen activism is and government action. Those are crucial, but they're not the only levers of change. Businesses have to worry about employee morale, and in certain businesses, environment is part of that. Or they have to worry about what other businesses might insist that they do, you know, business-to-business pressure, or what supply chains, you know, if Walmart decides it wants to sell only organic t-shirts, all of a sudden, you know, there's a tremendous new demand for organic cotton. So even if the farmers don't want to change, if they want to still sell to Walmart, they have to. That was something I never thought about before. And that doesn't make, you know, even though Walmart is doing a number of things like that, doesn't make them green, but it makes them more complicated than the caricature that we often have of big corporations. And they're often divided within themselves. That was certainly true in DuPont. There were parts of DuPont that wanted DuPont to do more about pollution than other parts. And understanding that tension within the company, I think, is really important if you want to figure out how to effectively push the companies to do more in the future. You need to know something about what constrained them in the past.
Yeah, those are really interesting points. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about in my work is the ways in which those sort of decision-making process, but also just the sort of chemical industrial processes that go into making the things of our lives, that in a lot of environmental education, because the focus is on the problems that those chemical industrial processes create, I think a lot of us still aren't that educated about how those processes actually work and the ways in which we're still dependent on them, whether we like them or not. So I think about, you know, how the importance of outdoor recreation and wilderness experiences are still to a lot of environmental education programs and a lot of environmentalists, and they're important to me and a big part of my life, and they're very complicated experiences. But a lot of those still depend on this gear that's created through these processes. And I think about the canoe that my wife and I own. It has a Kevlar inside, you know, which is an invention of the DuPont company.
Right.
And, you know, so if I'm going to keep using that canoe, I should probably try to understand the processes that went into it and the ways in which I'm still dependent on it. Unless I want to try to, you know, make my own birch bark canoe or something, I'm enrolled in these companies and in the processes that they engage in day in and day out.
Yeah, those are great points. And, you know, I think the work that you're doing is going to be really interesting because how environmental studies programs have evolved is really important. You know, people put such faith in them back in the Earth Day era as part of our salvation. But at least from what I found, when they drew on scientists, the scientists were almost always biologists or ecologists. They weren't usually chemists or even physicists or not as often engineers either. So they didn't have as much of that knowledge that you're talking about how things actually are made and how they work. They were much more looking at the end result, which is a critical part of the education, obviously, too. And again, I didn't really start thinking about this until I looked at business. And then I suddenly discovered, there's this whole movement for green chemistry. And, you know, I actually have a nephew that's getting his PhD in chemistry, and that's one of the things he's really interested in. Not because he's an eco guy per se, but just because he thinks it's one of the waves of the future in the whole field. And it's about, you know, finding alternative ways of synthesizing the chemicals, making the chemicals from different materials that are inherently less hazardous. DuPont itself, for example, has moved away from or trying to move away from fossil fuel based chemicals to ones that are more biologically based. And we'll see how far they get. But, you know, these are really interesting ambitions. And again, bringing together the people that have to solve the problems with also the people that have a greater understanding of why we have the problems in the first place, I think is important.
Yeah, and it seems part of what I hear you saying is that while business, capitalist business, may not be able to really come up with solutions ultimately for environmental problems, or that, you know, their practices may be creating those problems in the first place, that doesn't mean there aren't people within those businesses that have a lot of knowledge, talent, experience that those of us in the environmental community should really be listening to or engaging with.
Absolutely. And I've learned a lot in the you know, the beginning phases of working on the history of sustainability from talking to people. And I also learned a lot when I was doing the Earth Day thing, because a lot of the people that were Earth Day activists ended up going on to spend the whole rest of their careers working on these issues. And as I learned about what they'd done since, some of them broke away from their early government-based or nonprofit-based activism and became more entrepreneurial, or they became involved in other ways with different kinds of problem solving. But I think that the green capitalism question, you know, my students occasionally ask me at the end of the term, you know, do you think capitalism can ever be green? And usually I say, I don't know, but let's try. And it may be that in the trying, it becomes more obvious that the answer is no, and that then it becomes more obvious that we have to give a lot more thought to what other ways we can organize an economy that are satisfactory. But in the meantime, in the world we live in now, I don't see any path forward that doesn't start with trying to green business and understand where that's easy and where that's hard and where that might ultimately be impossible.
Hmm. And for you, in terms of moving forward with your research, what sort of questions are you pursuing these days along these lines?
The one other question that really interested me after I started to think about things like, you know, the publication of The Ecology of Commerce, I thought national environmental politics has been stalemated until now. Maybe we're about to have the stalemate break, unfortunately, but it's been stalemated since the Reagan years. Reagan tried to undo a lot of the environmental legislation of the 70s. He wasn't able to do that, but he, I think, ultimately won the ideological battle. So we haven't really had any major new environmental legislation dealing with anything that's come since 1970s. And, you know, that's been true whether the president was Republican or Democrat. There's been that stalemate. And yet there's been tremendously greater interest in trying to make the basic institutions of American society more sustainable. So one of the big research questions that I've been thinking about is where does that pressure come from? If it's not coming from national politics or from new regulation, what's behind it? And again, how far can it take us? What are its limits? Those are questions I'm really interested in as well.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to read more of your stuff in the future when it comes to publication. Yeah, this has been a really great conversation, and I thank you for all your time and insights, Adam.
Well, it's been my pleasure. You asked all kinds of great questions, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Wonderful. All right, well, thank you so much, and look forward to talking and reading more of your work in the future.
All righty, take care.
That was SUNY Buffalo Professor of History Adam Rome chatting with Andy Davey, a PhD candidate in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They were talking about two of Rome's books, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation, published by Hill and Wang in 2013, and the brand new Green Capitalism, Business and the Environment in the 20th Century, which is co-edited by Harmut Berghoff and available now from the University of Pennsylvania Press. You've been listening to Edge Effects, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by me, Brian Hamilton. The music you're listening to is by Julian Lynch. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a conversation with writer William DeBuys. Get that episode and all that follow sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in the iTunes Store. You can also find us on Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review. And as always, keep up with the steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgeeffects.net.